On this episode of What's What, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the emergence of the military-industrial complex, and why it all still matters 60 years later.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
What's up, Roosh?
You want to tell them who that was?
That was President Dwight D. Eisenhower on his way out of office in 1961, his farewell address to the nation.
So that kind of sets us up for where we are in history.
Yeah. So a pretty shocking thing to hear from an American president, especially at the time. People thought that it was just something that was kind of snuck in last minute, but he was very intentional in what he was saying. So Eisenhower is the president that preceded John F. Kennedy, which we're talking about the Kennedy assassination today. And the reason we're playing that speech first is because, like you said, that kind of sets the tone for what's to happen in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s and 90s and today.
So basically what he's saying is post-World War II, I guess, and World War I. It was during that period of time that America became such a militarized country.
Yeah, the militarization.
Became a big industry.
Right, yeah, the confluence of military force, industrial force, political force.
And then now we're entering the beginning of the Cold War, right? So
yeah.
He's basically saying that the undesired influence is like communist influence, and therefore we have to maintain this military-industrial complex to protect ourselves from undesired influences, I think is what he called it.
Well, he was saying the undesired influence was the influence of the military-industrial complex itself. That's what was so shocking about it, because Dwight D. Eisenhower was the general that was largely responsible for helping to defeat the Axis powers in Europe. Mm. And he saw the buildup of the military-industrial complex after World War II, and it scared the shit out of him, because he realized, like, oh, wait, America's the only untouched superpower on Earth after World War II. You know, all the other superpowers have basically been destroyed, and we've built up this huge machine, this military-industrial machine, and he saw how dangerous that was for the reasons that we're going to explore in the rest of this episode, specifically as it relates to John F. Kennedy and what happened to JFK. So if people, I mean, I'm sure everybody knows the story.
Well, I think you'd be surprised.
The story of Kennedy being assassinated in Dallas in November November 22nd, 1963. This noise is so terrible.
Yeah, it's not great.
I hope that we're able to...
Hopefully they'll finish building that house soon.
Yeah, I hope so. It's like right next door. So maybe on the surface, everybody knows, you know, that those are the historical facts. 1963, young, ambitious, hopeful president is executed in broad daylight.
Assassinated, yeah.
Well, I mean, it was a public...
It was a headshot. Well, I mean, the neck shot, and then it was a headshot.
An execution in the sense that it was on display. You know, there were people there watching, just, you know, thousands.
So he's driving down
in
a motorcade with his wife in the car,
mm-hmm.
top down. Not the car's top is down, not the wife's.
Right.
And and then he is shot. And there's a debate on how many bullets were actually fired, right?
The official story is three.
Three.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So the official story is it was a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone, firing from the sixth story of the Texas School Book Depository.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, well, let me tell a little personal anecdote here, and then we can kind of get into the quote-unquote conspiratorial aspects of this. But, yeah, that's the official story, is it was Lee Harvey Oswald. He acted alone. He was kind of the sketchy figure that was known to some of the national security and intelligence agencies in the United States, even though after the assassination, the CIA specifically pretended like they had no idea who he was, which is not true. They were tracking him. He had worked for the military at military institutions that were or military
He'd
bases.
Been to Russia.
He had defected to the Soviet Union. Yeah, he had defected to the Soviet Union.
And then he was allowed to come back. So did he really defect?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. There's so much mystery around mm-hmm. who Oswald was. But the facts still remain, as much as the CIA wants to pretend like they don't know who he was or didn't know who he was. They did.
Yeah.
They did. They were tracking him. They don't know if he was some kind of double agent or... if you want to go down the path of the conspiracy theories, that he was actually working for the CIA in some capacity, and they set him up as the patsy to take the fall for the larger conspiracy. So, I think it's important to, like, kind of take a step back here and understand, like, all the different players in the story, because there are mm-hmm. a lot of them. There are a lot of them. I mean, the first one, the most important one, is JFK himself. And as we established there with the clip that we played of Eisenhower, he's stepping into office in 1961 into this very heated environment
mm-hmm.
where you've got the Cold War really starting to heat up. You've got a lot of hardliners, both in America and in the Soviet Union, that are kind of hell-bent on war, like direct conflict with one another. And then you have that combined with the financial interest of huge companies.
And the nuclear terror.
And then the nuclear threat as well. So Kennedy really represented a new generation, a generation of hope. You know, he was Obama's hope message way before Obama. And there were so many people, you know, people of color, young people, people on the more progressive liberal side of things that looked at Kennedy as the future.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it was all the more devastating when he was killed. You know, it was
He was also, I guess, Eisenhower started the Vietnam War, and then Kennedy was inheriting it.
Yeah,
right. And he didn't really. He kind of was like, not so keen on it.
Yeah, at that point in the late 50s or mid 50s and late 50s, the military personnel, American military personnel that were in Vietnam, were more as kind of a security force, advisory force, and Eisenhower himself was reluctant to mm-hmm. actually put combat troops, a lot of combat troops, in Vietnam because he recognized what was going on
mm-hmm.
with the military-industrial complex and this intense interest for starting conflict, not just in Vietnam, but in many places in the world. So Eisenhower himself was reluctant, and yes, Kennedy steps into this very tricky situation, which is like, what do we do? What do we do here? I've got all these generals and seasoned military people telling me that we've got to stop the communist threat. We've talked about this before, mm-hmm. the whole domino theory. But I think he knew in his heart what was actually going on, and he wanted to, and he actually had signed executive orders limiting the involvement of the American military in Vietnam, basically saying he drew a hard line saying that we're not going to have military personnel or not active combat mm-hmm. troops there. There'll be a strictly advisory role, keeping an eye on the situation. And, of course, people in the military, people in that military-industrial complex didn't like that.
Yeah.
Because either one, they were just... I mean, one interpretation of it is to say that they were pure warmongers and they just had a financial interest. I mean, it's partly true, but it's also partly that they actually believed this.
I think a lot of the time they do, and I think that is part of the industrial complex.
Well,
the
it absolutely is.
It's also this aspect of convincing people that that's what you need, that you need a big military, and that it should be doing things, you know?
Yeah.
That's part of the complex.
But there is a conviction there, and I'm not trying to excuse it. I'm just saying that it's what makes it dangerous. It's not just about money. It's about a worldview that says that there is no coexistence. Because we have to also understand, if you look at the events leading up to his assassination, that he and Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev was the leader of the Soviet Union at the time, actually started to form a relationship, because I think they were both rational people that understood that they needed to be able to exist in some kind of equilibrium, mm-hmm. and some kind of détente is the word that they use for it. Détente just means a ceasing of tensions, you know, a commitment to some lasting peace. And him and Khrushchev, Kennedy and Khrushchev, kind of agreed on that. But you had, like we were talking about a second ago, you have people in both their governments that did not even, that wasn't their worldview.
Yeah,
their worldview is more the Henry Kissinger type, the what they would call like realpolitik, which is there are large powers in the world and they're going to battle and they're going to shape out their sphere of influence and they're going to maintain it. So to be fair to that worldview, that it's not just about money. They actually do believe this.
Mm-hmm.
They do believe that we're kind of destined to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We're destined to go to war and we're destined to do these things. Now, all that stuff aside, this is the environment that Kennedy is stepping into with this tremendous amount of hope and what some people would call naivete, and saying, well, this isn't really how the world works, which is why he posed such a serious threat to elements of the American military, to the CIA, to the mafia. There's a whole mafia connection that goes back to his father. But all that stuff aside, what was going on was it was a dangerous thing that he was stepping into, and I don't know if he really understood himself
mm-hmm.
how dangerous it was. You know, he was like in Oliver Stone's film JFK, which we'll play a clip from later. He says that he was Caesar, you know, surrounded mm-hmm. by all these enemies that he thought were his advisors and people on his side, but in fact they were his enemies. And ultimately, if you believe this idea that the American military was involved, ultimately executed him, or a coup d'etat, as they say. So maybe now is a good time to play that clip, for I said later on, but might as well just play it now. So Oliver Stone, you watch this film. Oliver Stone's a pretty well-known American filmmaker. He did Born on the 4th of July. He did this film that we're going to play a clip from now. This is JFK. And this is a kind of not fictionalized, but definitely a dramatic retelling of this, a story of this district attorney in New Orleans named Jim Garrison. And Jim Garrison is played by Kevin Costner in the film. And Jim Garrison, he's a real person. He was the only person to bring charges, conspiracy charges, against another individual other than Lee Harvey Oswald. In the case of John F. Kennedy's murder.
It was very soon after he was assassinated that these conspiracy theories like came up. It's not like, it wasn't like 5 years later people were looking back on it. It was pretty immediate already, the reaction that, hey, this was kind of fishy.
Yeah.
Something doesn't make sense.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah, because you have, I mean, if you watch newsreels from the day it happened, you've got people saying things. Well, you have the White House, I think he's the White House press secretary, announcing Kennedy's death, or announcing that he's mortally wounded. I don't think he was officially declared mm-hmm. dead at this point, but he said he's got a gunshot through his head. And he actually, the press secretary, and this is hours after it happened, saying, pointing to his head like this, because he probably saw the president after he was shot, indicating that he was shot, or I think he did it on his right side, indicating that the president was shot from the front, which, if you buy the Lee Harvey Oswald narrative that Oswald was the lone gunman, that wouldn't be possible because he shot from behind. And then you had people saying, again, newsreels from the day, accounts from the day, audio and film recordings from the day, saying, yes, there was the gunshots came from the grassy knoll, they came from behind the picket fence. So this is almost at street mm-hmm. level, not at the book depository. So yeah, to your point, there were people that kind of saw with their own eyes and heard with their own ears what happened,
mm-hmm.
and that directly conflicted with the narrative that the government was pushing, that the Warren Commission would conclude. The Warren Commission was the commission that was
set up by Lyndon B. Johnson
To look into what happened. So why don't we, I think this is a good time to play this clip. This is from Oliver Stone's 1991 film JFK. Kevin Costner plays Jim Garrison. And just to set this up for people, he is talking to some source that, from what we can gather, is some kind of black ops, military, CIA-like person. And he's got some interesting things to tell Jim Garrison, played by Kevin Costner, in the process of his investigation. So let's go ahead and watch this, and we can talk about it.
And don't underestimate the budget cuts that Kennedy called for in March of 63 either. Nearly 52 military installations in 25 states, 21 overseas bases. You're talking big money. You know how many helicopters have been lost in Vietnam? Nearly 3,000 so far. Who makes that? Bell Helicopter. Who owns Bell? Well, Bell was nearly bankrupt when the First National Bank of Boston approached the CIA about developing the helicopter for Indochina usage. How about the F-111 fighter? General Dynamics of Fort Worth, Texas. Who owns that? Find out the defense budget since the war began. 75, going on 100 billion. Nearly 200 billion to be spent before it's over. In 1949, it was 10 billion. No war, no money. The organizing principle of any society, Mr. Garrison, is for war. The authority of the state over its people resides in its war powers. And Kennedy wanted to end the Cold War in his second term. He wanted to call off the moon race in favor of cooperation with the Soviets. He signed a treaty with the Soviets to ban nuclear testing. He refused to invade Cuba in 1962, and he set out to withdraw from Vietnam. But all of that ended on the 22nd November, 1963. As early as 1961, they knew Kennedy was not going to go to war in Southeast Asia. Like Caesar, he is surrounded by enemies and something's underway. But it has no face. Yet everybody in the loop knows.
You can forget about your combat troops. He told McNamara he is going to pull out the goddamned advisors. He fucked us in Laos, and now he is going to fuck us in goddamn Vietnam.
He won't implement it before the election. He can't afford to.
I hear the NSC meeting was a real barn burner.
I wouldn't have missed it for the world. Heads are going to roll everywhere. Did you hear what Lemnitzer did?
What happened?
Kennedy tried to rub Lem's nose in shit, saying if we didn't go into Cuba, which is so close, why should we go into Vietnam, which is so far away?
Son of a bitch, there he goes again. He's got his hands on the chicken switch.
Anyway, Lem said that the chiefs still think we ought to go into Cuba.
Money's at stake. Big money. $100 billion. Kennedy brothers target voting districts for those defense dollars. They give TFX fighter contracts only to those counties that are going to make a difference in 64, and the people in the loop, they fight back. Their way.
We have to control the intelligence from Saigon.
Well, just don't let McNamara start sticking his damn nose in this thing. Every time he goes over to Saigon on some fucking fact-finding mission, he comes back and just scares the shit out of the president. Now, won't Max Taylor own him night and day, like a fly on shit? Now, you control McNamara, and you control Kennedy.
I think it started like that, in the wind. Defense contractors, big oil bankers, just conversations, nothing more. Then a call is made, maybe to someone like my superior officer, General Y.
Yeah.
We're going. We need your help.
When?
In the fall, probably in the south. We want you to come up with a plan.
I can do that.
Everything is cellularized. No one has said he must die. There's been no vote, nothing's on paper. There's no one to blame. It's as old as the crucifixion. Military firing squad. Five bullets, one blank, no one's guilty. Because everyone in the power structure who knows anything has a plausible deniability. There are no compromising connections except at the most secret point. But what's paramount is that it must succeed. No matter how many die, no matter how much it costs, the perpetrators must be on the winning side and never subject to prosecution for anything by anyone. That is a coup d'etat.
So that's Lyndon Johnson there at the end. And the implication that Oliver Stone is making with that scene is that that's the beginning of the conspiracy in the American military and amongst American politicians, going as high up as Lyndon Johnson and the CIA in assassinating the president. Now, a lot of people, I remember hearing a lot of criticism of Oliver Stone's film because I think, and I want to get, we'll take a break here in a minute, and then I want to get to the why it's relevant and why this still matters part of it. But I think that first you got to understand like what the kind of groups of people, when you talk about conspiracies, specifically this one, there's kind of the people that are the hardcore conspiracy theorists that buy this stuff hook, line, and sinker, right? And they say, okay, yep, this is how it is, right? There are the people that, for whatever reason, have an interest on the other side opposing mm-hmm. these conspiracy theories. Either they're directly involved or they benefit from it somehow. And there's another group, which is just kind of average people that don't want to believe that this kind of stuff goes on. You know, there's mm-hmm. this kind of, they just turn a blind eye to it because it's so much to really accept that your government is capable of doing those things and that it has done those things. It's just too much. You know, it's like some people want to turn a blind eye to it. And that's why getting to the why it still matters is that first there are a lot of these same elements, these same forces, if not direct descendants, literally and metaphorically, of these same people that exist in government and exist in positions of power today. But also because it kind of really captures that eternal struggle between conflict and peace. Mm-hmm. You know, like, yeah. are we destined to be a species that's constantly in conflict with ourselves? Yeah, that's, I don't know if we're going to be able to get that noise out. So I'm sorry if you guys hear that. I was successful in getting the noise out from the other episode, yeah. But this one's a little bit louder. So they're building another village. You see across me too. They're already clearing the land. They're going to probably,
really?
Yeah. So anyway, sorry about that. Yeah. So conflict, but you know what I'm saying though, right? It's like that's why it's got such a lasting impression. Because it gets right to the core of a lot of these questions we ask ourselves.
Even now we've spoken in the past of kind of government's involvement. And I think during this period in time with the kind of coup that went on in Iran and Guatemala, the CIA was a bit worse at hiding their tracks. And I think a lot of the things that they did back then have now come to light. And people are scared to admit that these kind of underground secret service things do go on around us, but I think it's naive to, I mean, with conspiracy theories, when I hear them, I try not to like believe them fully, but I do appreciate the seeds of doubt that they plant.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And it just creates more questioning than just blindly following what's going on in the news. I don't think it's really safe either to follow into conspiracy theories all the time because they do have a kind of tendency to make assumptions, you know, and there isn't, maybe the facts are hidden, but there is an assumptive tendency to them. So I think that's kind of dangerous to just go full conspiracy. But I think using them as an element of like understanding that you maybe shouldn't believe the regular news.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the same way you shouldn't believe a conspiracy theory the whole way, and that there is a gray area in a lot of the information that we're given. And I think the more things that come to light, the more we see that. What's funny is about the JFK, so apparently there was like these documents put together in 1992, and then they were supposed to be released 25 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Which would have been 2017, mm-hmm. but then the president can decide to postpone the release. So during the Trump presidency, he decided to postpone the release. And then just recently, the president, whose name is escaping me.
Biden. Our current president.
Most forgettable president. Biden also just decided to postpone
really?
The release of them. Yeah, but it would be like 98% of the things. It's called the President's Commission on the Assassination of President... Oh, no, sorry, that's the Warren Commission. It's called something else, but there's a bunch of documents
there was
that have still not been released about what happened, even though it was like 60 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. There was a Senate subcommittee that came out. I think it was just the Committee on Assassinations. It had some formal name, it was separate from the Warren Commission that I think
that was like in 1979.
Maybe it was in 79, and there was a continuation of it into the 90s. But that is interesting to hear that. I didn't know that about Trump and Biden. But that's interesting if people think that Trump is fighting back against the deep state, that he was just as vulnerable as any other American president once he finally got in office, that I guess that deep state force, which is perfectly captured in the military-industrial complex and all this and this theory around JFK's assassination, when you talk about the deep state, that's what he's talking about. That's what Trump was talking about. And to see that he just gave in.
I think there must be a lot of pressure surrounding the release of these documents. So it's called the President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act of 1992. Mm-hmm. And it was actually in response to the Oliver Stone film that they put this commission or this act together. Mm-hmm. And it said that it should be released no later than 25 years after the act was made. And then it says, unless the President of the United States certifies that continued postponement is made necessary by an indefinable harm to the military defense, intelligence operations, law enforcement, or conduct of foreign relations, and two, the harm is of such a great gravity it outweighs public interest in disclosure. Hmm. So that's apparently the only reason that the president's allowed to delay it, and there have so far been two presidents that have chosen to delay.
So it's
Biden said it was because of COVID.
Okay, oh, that, yeah, that makes complete sense. Well, I guess if you look at it, if it were the fact, and I do, to be clear, I really do believe that it was elements of the CIA that assassinated JFK. I mean, I think
they're still obviously not releasing these documents, so there's...
Well, yeah, so in their mind,
if they had nothing to hide, they would release them.
Yeah, I mean, we got to be careful when we say they, though. I mean, a lot of the people that were directly involved with the assassination are dead by now.
Yeah, but you're still not going to be like, oh, yeah, handing out documents that the CIA, which still exists as an organization today, was doing something as drastic and shady as that. I think they had an idea that, you know, by 2017,
people would forget about it.
Yeah, the truth can come out. But I think actually with the way that things have gone since then, you're not in a safe place to release those documents.
That is a great place. We got to take a quick break. Just let the camera cool down and take a commercial break. That's a great place to leave, and I want to pick right back up with that, because that's exactly why, well, one of the main reasons why it's still relevant, why the assassination is still relevant, exactly what you just said, the strong distrust of government from both sides
and
of
then,
the political
Yeah, which
spectrum.
Created the counterculture movement and also the escalation of Vietnam. But we'll get into what happened after JFK was assassinated.
Indeed.
Basically, after.
Yeah, we'll see on the other end. Okay, and we're back. And the construction just gets louder and louder and louder.
We're going to try my house next week.
Yeah, let's do that. Okay, so we wanted to talk about distrust of the government. I mean, specifically as it relates to the assassination, and again, get into the theme, one of the themes, the main themes of today's show, why does this still matter? Why are we talking about this 60 years later? So let's first play a clip. So this is another part of that scene from Oliver Stone's 1991 film JFK. So that scene that we played earlier with Kevin Costner talking to this black ops military CIA dude, this is another part of this scene. And we're going to jump in a little bit. I think this is a little bit later. I don't remember exactly where this is. But we'll play this, and then we will talk about that, the continuation of that distrust that started. Okay? So here we go.
Well, I never thought things were the same after that. Vietnam started for real. There was an air of, I don't know, make-believe in the Pentagon and CIA. Those of us who'd been in secret ops since the beginning knew the Warren Commission was fiction. But there was something deeper, uglier. I knew Alan Dulles very well. I'd briefed him many a time in his house. But for the life of me, I still can't figure out why he was appointed to investigate Kennedy's death, the man who had fired him. Dulles, by the way, was General Wythe's benefactor. I got out in 64, resigned my commission.
I never realized Kennedy was so dangerous to the establishment. Is that why?
Well, that's a real question, isn't it? Why? The how and the who is just scenery for the public. Oswald, Ruby, Cuba, the mafia. Keeps them guessing like some kind of parlor game, prevents them from asking the most important question, why? Why was Kennedy killed? Who benefited? Who has the power to cover it up?
So, what he said there at the end, it's the why that's the important question. And the why gets to what we want to talk about in the second half of this episode, which is there is the establishment, there is what you would call the deep state. There are elements that are deeply entrenched in the American government and other governments as well, but I think the most notable example is in the American government, that have a certain worldview like we talked about earlier, and they've got a grasp on power in whatever way, and they've got an interest in maintaining that. Now, that's fine, you know, that's how governments go, but I think what makes this different is that in America in the 50s, 60s, and coming up to today, is there's a belief that there is a certain amount of freedom of information, there's freedom of thought, we know there's some transparency. And what I think is so important about the JFK assassination is you realize, like, oh wait, there isn't a lot of transparency there. There are a lot of really dark forces in government that have done some really terrible things. And either they've done it completely out in the open and they're just so brazen and they're just so audacious that they just don't even care. It's like, yes, we did this, prove it. Or they just convince people to, like we talked about earlier, just kind of turn a blind eye and not even acknowledge the fact or even begin to acknowledge the fact that they're capable of this.
There's that guy Alan Dulles who's mentioned in that clip. So he was the director of the CIA up until the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Yep,
so a bit of history here. JFK basically gets convinced to do the Bay of Pigs invasion by the defense team, and they send like 1,500 Cuban like anti-Castro people.
So anti-Castro Cubans.
People who fled from Cuba to the United States, then got like trained in sort of military fashion, and then they were sent back and completely outnumbered, and it was a big failure. And so in the aftermath of this, JFK fired Alan Dulles and also said that he was quoted saying he was going to split the CIA into a million pieces.
And have it scatter in the wind. Yeah, that's what he said. Yeah,
what's ironic is that, mentioned in that clip, is that Alan Dulles then becomes the senior of the Warren Commission, which is the commission who's supposed to be investigating the death of JFK. This is true. Even though it's from a sort of dramatized movie, this is fact. And it is a bit weird that the guy that he fired is now in charge of, you know, yeah, a bit weird there.
It is very weird. And yeah, all this points to, again, this idea of distrust and what we still experience today, where you've got people on the left and on the right with a very strong distrust of government. And it's easy to dismiss those people. And nowadays it's more people on the right that are distrustful. But it's easy to dismiss them and say, oh, well, you know, government doesn't do that. Government's a force for good. But when you look back at what the CIA was doing at that time, and still does today, maybe not as obvious, it was essentially the same thing. You know, they were installing American-backed dictators in some cases in sometimes free countries that were awful people that were just protecting the interests of the United States. And that is, again, it's a tough thing to grapple with. Because you realize that the world is not as simple as good and bad. It's not as simple as democracy versus authoritarianism. And yeah, I think Alan Dulles is a perfect example of that, because some people would say, and Stone basically comes out and says it in this film, that he was complicit in the assassination plot. And again, all the way up to Lyndon Johnson himself being complicit in it. And it's not that much of a reach. You know, people say conspiracy theory, and it's just not. I mean, there's so many facts to point to, like historical facts that even mainstream historians will agree on. Like you said, like Alan Dulles is a real character in this story.
Yeah.
And everything that Oliver Stone talks about, and the source in the film that's talking to Kevin Costner's character, a lot of that stuff really happened. There is no interpretation. So I guess the question is then, where do you go with that? You know, here we sit 60 years later. We've all had many reasons to distrust our governments, the, you know, the corporations that work with the governments, the people in power, you know, people in power at large. So what do we do with that? How do we take what we think we know about the misuse of that power and, one, make sure it doesn't happen again, but then, two, take some kind of ownership over our own governance and change that narrative? What do you think?
I mean, it's hard to say. I'm always one for, like, the system that we have doesn't really work and we don't really know where the better system is, but I think continuing that longevity. There's also, like, a very, no offense, but, like, governments all over the world are made up of a very kind of small demographic of people. I mean, in the United States, it's obviously, like, male. I'm not going to say anything about skin color, but just men-dominated industry. Politics in general, I think globally, is a male, kind of male-dominated industry. And I think...
Well, it's not an industry, but...
Well, yeah.
Whatever. I mean, the...
Profession.
The exercise then, of governance.
And even, the, like, the way that politicians... Like, even... I mean, JFK is a bit of a... Not a... bit of an anomaly, but, like, the way he was raised was very much groomed to go into politics. And a lot of politicians these days are groomed in this fashion. And then if you start that process young, you're obviously going to end up with the same ideologies and the same mentalities in governance that you've had for generations, because they're being groomed for that. Happens in the UK as well, like in Eton, for example. Like, you know, there is, like, certain politicians go to certain schools, and you know that it gives you a leg up because it creates the network, and then it, you know, is your in. So I think somehow, for me, like, diversifying politicians and diversifying politics, and or at least creating voices for people, but I mean, that then against goes up against general authority, so governments probably aren't going to be like, yeah, let's do that, you know, like, let's show all sides of the coin. And
yeah, but the, I mean, the whole idea of diversification for the sake of diversity itself, I mean, what does that really mean?
I think
mean?
That's really important, actually.
But what do you actually mean when you say diversity? I mean, what does that word mean to you?
Like, people from different backgrounds and
What kind of backgrounds, though?
Well, a variety of backgrounds.
Well, first, the people...
And I think the acts, like, the people that end up in politics have access to it because of their upbringing a lot of the time.
Well, I know, but this is where you and I kind of...
And I think you create, like, a more neutral or, like, fair playing ground
But what does that mean, fair playing ground? What do you mean
by
that?
Well, not, like... Well, elitist universities feed directly into, like, you know, and that creates a system, because you're going from Princeton into politics, or you're going from Yale into politics, and a lot, and even happens in the stock market and Wall Street as well. Like, there is a trajectory that people have to take in order to maybe, like, more grassroots organizations, like, but I think this trajectory and this, like, path that politicians end up having, you kind of have to take it if you want to end up in politics, is kind of what I mean. So there's no really, like, very alternative routes to get into those heads of state positions, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
Well,
I don't
yeah.
know what the alternative routes are, but it creates a narrow demographic of people who have access to that.
Well, and also the people themselves, the individuals themselves, need to have the desire to do that. So, I mean, just that alone makes a narrow pathway. There are only so many people that actually want to pursue that.
But I think it's a want, and also, what are you exposed to? I don't think a lot of low-income families, they even see that as a potential for them, because they're not exposed to that path at all. You know what I mean?
I suppose.
It's kind of, like, hard to explain, but, like, you're saying, do they want
to
do that? And
well,
I think there are probably a lot of kids who want to be the president of the United States.
But it's hard to explain because it's abstract. It's hard to explain because the whole concept of equality and diversity sounds nice when you think about it in the abstract. But then when you hit the actual reality, it is much more difficult. That's why it's hard to explain. Because you and I are both, and sorry, you more than me, are beneficiaries of these exact systems that you decry. I mean, if anything, I've been put at a disadvantage because my dad came up in the same military-industrial complex, warned me of it, was fired from his job because he spoke out against it, and now he is a retired man in his early 60s now with no money because he made the decisions he made. Now, you, on the other hand, you are a direct beneficiary of these capitalist systems that you decry. I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but that's just the reality of it. So when you say these things to me, it's like, I hear you.
I couldn't choose how I was born into.
But you directly benefit from it.
And the fact is, my dad was a stockbroker, and I know I'm never going to buy stock because my dad was a stockbroker. So does that really?
Well, yeah, it does, because you benefit directly from it. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Like watching what, like his lifestyle and what he's doing for his job, has made me say no. I actually don't want to do that.
But you also, you run a business.
Yeah, where I make food and employ people and serve.
Well, I know, but you also take advantage of these free market principles, and you take advantage of that entrepreneur. And I say this with respect and admiration. You know that I admire that about you. But I think that there's a little bit of a disconnect, because it seems like...
But there's
like
a difference between, for me, I could have gone into like a very corporate hospitality brand.
Well, exactly, because everything you just described
was the system that you were, but I opted not to do that. And I now have an independent restaurant, which employs 12 people.
Which is great.
Which is actually, from my perspective in the hospitality industry, is the way of stepping out of it. Is to create small businesses that directly employ local people.
But you still benefit from that worldview, though, is what I'm saying.
That there's money in the world?
Well, no, that there's such thing as a free market system, and you adhere to those free market principles, and you believe that that's an open marketplace, and whatever you can sell your goods for, and whatever you can pay your employees, whatever the kind of minimum for that is to make money, that is what's acceptable, and that's what you're going to do, because that's what a business person does. All of these are predicated on the same exact worldview, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
So to say, to make it more diverse and make it more equal, again, sounds nice in theory, but...
I mean, you can create these opportunities for people, and you can create scholarships, and you can create the trajectory to go into politics for people who don't have that right now. And I don't think that goes on.
Who is you? Rushi, of course it does. Come on.
Not to the scale that it could.
But again, this is why it's so difficult to describe, because in the abstract, everything you're saying sounds nice. But what does that actually mean? Giving people opportunities. What does that actually mean? Giving scholarships out, but you're going to have to be way more specific. Giving scholarships out. But who and where and for what?
Okay, universities could give scholarships
and they
to
do.
Low income.
And they do.
Yeah.
And they do.
And I think that could be created at a bigger rate to create a more diversified political system globally, where like many walks of life are represented in heads of state.
But here's the problem with that, though, because again, getting back to this idea that we are beneficiaries of that system, if that were truly the case, then we would not benefit as much as we do. That's not true.
You could actually probably create greater schemes for more people to benefit if you had more representation in the government.
Like how?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a politician.
Well, I know, but you have these ideas about what would make it better.
You're not trying to throw out a free market system. You're just trying to create more points of view so that you don't have just groupthink going on, which is what happened with Bay of Pigs and what happened with Vietnam, and it's what happens in the government now is like a groupthink, because everyone is from the same place, all following the same mindset, and everyone thinks that what they're doing is the right thing. Whereas if you had more people like JFK who were able to speak up or have a different worldview,
but my issue would
end up with a possibly a system.
But from your mind, you say more diverse, and the first things you point to are race and gender,
and income.
But that's so unfair, because by saying that, you're immediately setting this framework that there are races and genders that are inherently more inclined to go in that direction, and there are other races and genders that are more inclined to go a more passive, more peaceful direction. That's what it sounds like.
No, that's not what I'm saying. So I'm just saying that whatever agenda they have,
because
you have one type of person in the room, you're more likely to end up in this kind of groupthink, let's do this because that's what we will agree on.
That's exactly what's happening in America right now with this whole diversity initiative, is that you have a lot of people on the left that have this unbelievable groupthink where they think that it is diversity.
Yes, but that's not diversity because everyone in the room is from the left.
So what? So if you boil it down to just race and gender,
and income,
then that's what you're saying. But race, gender, and income. Okay.
That is like the basis of what makes people different.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. Well, I don't want to get into the transgender thing.
Gender, income, upbringing, like these are the things that make diversity. These are the things that make everyone different.
I mean, I suppose. I think there are different. I don't think it's that simple, though, is what I'm saying. And I think that by advocating for diversity, I think what diversity means is not as many white men. I think let's just be honest about that. That's what it means. Diversity
or Chinese men. I mean,
diversity
like,
in the
depends,
modern. But
it depends
that's,
which government
let,
you're looking
can
at.
Can we just be honest about that right
no,
now?
No, it
though?
Depends what in China. Okay, well, it's all Chinese men.
Well, right,
you know,
right. But
like
wait, we're
every,
talking about
anywhere in the world.
But we're talking about America right now. So when you say diversity, you mean less white men. Is that fair to say?
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, my point is that
Men who have been in the same, like, who have gone through the same trajectory and been to these same elite universities, who then end up in these same positions, senators and whatnot, like, it's not just that they're white men, it's that the fact that they've followed this set course on how to be a politician. And I think that course of how to be a politician should become more inclusive.
Well, I can get on board with that. But what's interesting is that it seems to me that you are echoing a lot of the same things that people that support Trump say, which is, and I get that because I think that's what's so interesting about what's happening right now, is that as much as I dislike Trump and disagree with so much of what Trump stands for, that at the core of it, it seems like we're all saying the same thing, which is we don't like the established powers. We do not like what they've done to the world over the past 50, 60, 70, 80 years. So what's the alternative? And it seems to me that people on the right will say, well, the alternative is to, like you said, throw all those bums out, get new people in. But you
that's
would
not
dis-
what I said. I said, that's well, absolutely I mean, not what I said. I said, I mean, create opportunities
to
and a
get
more
the people
inclusive
out, to get people to get, yeah, I know, but there's only, there's a finite, that yeah, position. That's a nice way to put it. There are a finite number of positions in, just take the American government as a concrete example. So in order to have more people of different perspectives in, you're going to have to get rid of other people that were there before.
But
so
I think
this
most,
idea,
I mean, it's also a generational thing. I think a lot of them are well into their 60s and 70s, and it is going to be a matter of shift. But it's there's always people changing in all these positions. And I'm not saying fire them all and replace them. I'm saying create systems that create a more inclusive for the next generation.
But it doesn't have to be overnight. But
it's
I know, but
a
we
generational
we
get, shift.
We,
like
we come back to this boogeyman of systems. And I just, that's where I kind of have a hard time with it, because when we talk about these things, I'm like, okay, yeah, I get this. But then you say things like, well, it's the system.
It's a system. Okay. It's not a system that's been implemented. It's a system that the society has created by itself.
So wait, it hasn't been implemented?
Like nobody thought it through. It's how it has developed, the way the system has developed.
Well, what system are you talking about?
I'm talking
exactly?
about this system of to become a politician. There's like certain steps that you need to take and certain backgrounds that are more included in that opportunity.
Well, I know, but my issue with it is...
And that's just the way that it's been. And
I know, but
fine,
my issue
but
with
it
is that the solution, oftentimes when I talk to people, they will point to the boogeyman of society and the system and all of these more abstract things that are very hard to define. And that is, it's a difficult one for me because I'm like, okay, well, what do you really mean by that? And what do you mean by changing the system? You think that changing the system is going to change human nature?
No.
Or do you think that changing the system is just going to allow whatever group of people that you believe should, the more diverse group of people, quote unquote, to do the same exact thing?
It could end up that way.
Well, of course it's going to.
Not necessarily. Right now, the way that it is that it's a very small demographic of people, whereas...
But there is a possibility that if you change this demographic,
you might start getting new ideas.
What numbers are you citing by saying it's a small demographic?
I mean, it's a small representation of the demographic.
Well, of course, that's how representative democracy works.
Yes, though. But I mean that these people are generally from a similar background. And what I'm saying is,
so if that's the case, then why is there so much tension? Yeah, I know, but
you might end up with more. I'm not saying
let's take American government as an example right now. Why is the American Congress so divided? Why are all the branches of government and everything in government right now so contentious and so divided? If all these people are coming from the same background, why are they arguing?
Because you
so
have
much?
Two and parties why have they, which cannot agree on
so
anything.
So I guess, okay, but, well, that's getting into a whole mechanical idea
but,
of how
but
a
then
representative
you have, you
democracy
basically have
should
two,
work.
Two matters of groupthink going on just happen to be in the same room.
Yeah, but again, this comes back to a very core thing, which is for whatever reason, there is a reluctance to accept the fact that sometimes there are binary choices. Sometimes you have to say, you can open yourself up.
I have a reluctance to that.
But at some point you have to make a decision about how things are going to go. At some point you say, we build this road, we don't build this road.
Yeah,
we
for
do
sure.
this thing, we don't yeah. do this thing. So, and this is where I struggle with this whole abstract thought of diversity and of changing the system. At a certain point, you have to make decisions. At a certain point, government
yes, but
needs
who
to
is
do
making
things.
Those decisions?
Well, I know,
and
but
I think that,
that has...
group of people could be better represented,
but...
is what I mean. And I think that's the only
but
way
according
to say...
But according to what numbers?
I don't know. I can look up how many white male senators
see,
there
and again,
are.
we come back to the same exact thing, which to you, this all boils down to race and gender. And that's what I think
and
is
income.
So important about it.
And income.
Yeah, but how unfortunate is that? That we talk through these things, you have these high-minded ideas of diversity and inclusion... But what you're really saying is less white men.
Well, no. I'm just saying a more representative and a more like more opportunity for people who don't have that access. Because I think what's happened now is that it just happens to be that rich white men are the ones that have access into those positions.
That is not always the case.
Not always the case. Agreed.
And that
but
it's
and,
just
and this happens all over the world, and it can be rich Chinese people of influence, not even necessarily rich, just like high up families who end up in the Chinese government. And the same thing happens in Singapore. You have a legacy of a dynasty of Kwans and Yus
that
have ended up in Singapore.
Because the reality is that people are different. People are different. People have different capacity for doing different things, which is why you're a business owner and why you're not an employee at a restaurant.
I was before, 5 years ago.
Right, but you're not. But you're not anymore. Why?
Because I chose to open a restaurant,
but,
and I had the means. But you know what? I may have now inspired the people that I employ the same way that I was inspired by the people who employed me to do what I do. And I think that's how things go. Like, perhaps some of the boys and girls that I work with now are gonna be like, "Oh, I'm gonna open my own restaurant," and cool, good, do it. But I don't think what happens in politics is that a lot of people are exposed or even think that they have that opportunity.
Maybe because they don't want it. Maybe because they're disillusioned with all of it.
Maybe.
So then we can talk in the abstract about changing the system and encouraging more diversity. All I'm advocating for is...
I think a lot of people also maybe don't think they have a chance because of the way that it is now, you know?
Or maybe they don't have a chance because that's just how the cards are dealt sometimes. And that's there seems to be this reluctance to accept the reality of discrepancy, right? There are discrepancies between humans. There is inherent inequality between human beings, of course. We are not the same. We do not have the same capacity, the same capabilities. And I guess what I have a hard time with is this belief that can all be changed by fixing the system.
Fixing the system, but that's... shifting it to give more opportunities to people who don't have those opportunities.
But see, I would come back to the thing that we talked about in the I think it was the propaganda episode, which is instead of pointing to this external boogeyman and saying that there are forces, which there are. I mean,
that was what the whole counterculture movement was. It
right.
was
and then, and
standing
then,
up to the boogeyman.
The counterculture movement was also all about? Basically rejecting their own personal responsibility, which is why parts of it failed miserably. Because a lot of those people, it was much easier for them to point to an external boogeyman and say, it's the military-industrial complex, it's all this, while you're sitting there still living your life in a way that does nothing to help help soothe those problems or provide solutions to those problems that you think exist.
I guess. So I don't know. I looked at corporate hospitality and I was like, oh, this is really destructive to the environment. And oh, none of the money actually stays in the country that it's in. And oh, this
is like. No, I wasn't talking about you.
Yeah, but I'm just saying there are also a lot of people who come out of it and who use the counterculture movement as an opportunity to say, I don't want to be part of this system anymore and I'm going to find an alternative route. Right now, yeah, I have a restaurant, but like in 10 years, I might be living on a remote island. Like, I don't know. I'm like making my steps out. But it's a process. And I don't think even changing the system, I don't think that's like an overnight thing. And I don't think anybody has the answers. But well, I think changing the way that it is now and like at least observing what's going on and how does that change things. And then generationally, okay, I'm not saying fire all the old white guys. I'm just saying
while we reap the benefits create, from it.
You know, for the next positions open up at some point, who is filling those positions? And it be the same category of people that we've had filling those positions for the last 50 years, or can we get new people ready to fill these positions and then see, okay, is this going to create any change or not?
Yeah, but this is all predicated on the idea that, again, coming back to this, because this is very important, predicated on the idea that these things boil down to race, gender, and money. And that's where I have a really hard time with it.
I think that's going to be for another episode. Because I think those are the things that set people apart.